Are you an entrepreneur, a designer, a developer? Never before has been easier to get your new venture off the ground. Whether you're just getting started or have already begun your journey, you've come to the right place. In each episode, we'll dive into a new challenge, breaking it down into simple, digestible terms. I'm Dimitri, and I'm speaking to John tonight, John Fox. Thank you very much, John, for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we go back maybe 3 years or so. Last time I remember we met down, we had some seafood in Piraeus.
Yeah.
Must have been a couple of years back when you were visiting. And now you're back again. And because of the time zone change, I thought, why not? Let's reach out to John and do a podcast together. So would you like to tell us a bit about yourself and what you do and anything else you want to talk about before we chat?
Yeah. So I guess I am primarily an iOS software engineer. I work at Netflix now. Before joining Netflix about a year and a half ago, I was an iOS engineer at a company called Findry, which is a startup started by Katarina Fake of Flickr fame. Before that, I'd had my own products, my own company. So I'm coming at the world of having, you know, worked at never having had been an employee since my days in college, and Findry was my first time being an employee, although at a tiny company with 12 people. And now I'm on a software development team of 12 people at a rather large company called Netflix that most people have heard of, and it seems many people like, perhaps too much. And I've been coming to Greece for the last 3 years. Over the last 3 years, this is now my fourth trip. And I came here because of my connection with Amsterdam, which I think is pretty well known, I think, among software developers here in Europe. And I came because I gave a talk that was put on by Amsterdam, Greece. But it was held at a place called the Orange Grove, which is a startup incubator that was started as a project of the Dutch embassy. And I guess they liked me enough when I gave my talk back then that they invited me back. So I was a judge at a pitch contest called The Squeeze a few years back. And I did some mentoring with the startups that were there. And I guess they liked that enough that they invited me back yet another time. So I'm actually going to be joining a panel tomorrow doing something called Startup Stories, which are kind of, you know, tales of hardship and hopeful success in the startup world. And then tomorrow there's on Thursday there's the Squeeze yet again. So there's it's a pitching contest with two prizes, cash prizes of 15,000 and 10,000 euros respectively. And then Friday I'll be doing some mentoring. And in between I've been eating souvlaki and having Freddo cappuccino, which I enjoy.
Okay. Where from originally? In the States?
Well, I've been living in San Francisco since 1989.
San Francisco.
And since
the reason I'm asking you is they don't have Freddo cappuccino in San Francisco.
They do, but it's so cold during the summer that nobody wants to drink it.
Okay.
But it's and it's quite a bit more expensive. One of the great luxuries of being in Athens is that you can get a delicious souvlaki for 2.5 euros and a fine cup of coffee for less.
How much would you?
And you can get aspirin if you've had too much to drink the evening before. You can get pain reliever. I was kind of shocked. I went to a pharmacy and got a nice pain reliever, paracetamol, I guess. I handed them a 20-euro note, and the guy looked at me strange. He's like, "Don't you have change?" It's like, "Well, how much is it?" It's 75 cents.
Unbelievable. How much is would a souvlaki set you back in San Francisco?
Well, funnily enough, there's a place called Souvla, which has now opened up two shops. They started in fancy Hayes Valley, and it's a guy of Greek origin, but who went to the Culinary Institute of America, so he had worked at large restaurants. And so he opened up a souvlaki shop, but it's, you know, it being California, all the ingredients come from animals and plants that live better lives than you and me. But there, a souvlaki is $7 or $8.
Wow! Yeah, that's pretty dear.
So it's which you know, yeah Yeah, it is. But it's, I mean, it is true that it is, it's very nice ingredients, but it's also, I mean, you have to say that, you know, the whole concept of organic and local is something that is kind of a requirement in the United States if you want something that's not industrialized food. And, you know, the tomatoes one finds in season here are quite nice, and the potatoes and whatnot are all quite good. And you, I feel less requirement to spend extra to kind of have something that's not entirely adulterated.
Awesome.
But that's a whole other topic of conversation.
It is. So in our podcast, we like to talk about the operational side of setting up a startup and try to look at the multiple angles that come out of that. Mm-hmm. So we've how to get started with your support, for example, what kind of methodology you use in order for carrying out your day-to-day development tasks, how to go about hiring people, mm-hmm. if you're a non-technical founder. Now, you used to work at a company called Findery.
Correct.
What did you do there, apart from?
Well, so I mean, just a brief thing about, you know, what Findery is about. So it was a location-based kind of storytelling application. So I think people remember Flickr as you know, mostly as the kind of photo sharing site, but in many ways it was the kind of grandmother of social media sites, in that it had the concept of following and followers and commentary and that type of thing. And so a lot of the mechanics that exist for social media sites that we all take for granted now were invented back then. And so Katerina had you know, done some other companies between then, but I think this is something that she wanted to do, because it was about the idea of about being able to annotate the physical world, meaning that, you know, if you go to a place, whether it's, you know, out in the countryside and you're talking about a particular waterfall somewhere, or you're in a neighborhood like Exarchia and there's a particular bit of street art that you're interested in, anything you can imagine that excites or interests people about physical places in the world, in any domain, it would be a nice thing to gather. So, you know, a lot of location-based social media sites like, you know, Foursquare or whatnot are establishing the fact that you are there, and then Facebook is kind of you're there and with your friends, you know, Jim, Bob, and Jane. And I think that Findery is more about kind of saying, you know, what is the meaning of the graffiti on the side of the wall there, or, you know, so it's more about experiences and kind of more humane aspects about places versus, you know, I looking for a place to eat or want to make sure that my social peacocking is in good order, so mm-hmm. to be able to say that I not only found the right place to eat, but I was there with the right people. And so that's what it was about. I joined the team because it was something that, you know, launching a new social media site of any sort is a daunting task. I think it helps if step zero is having already done a successful social media product, as was the case with this.
Okay.
But you have a chicken and egg problem with any type of social media sites, that, you know, nobody's going to come and use your service if nobody else is there. And so, you know, in order to get people to be interested, you have to have some starting point of content. So when I joined Findery, they had already been operating for about 2 years, and they were, you know, it was designed really for mobile devices, just because of, you know, what you get with them, a GPS-enabled video recorder or camera. With the internet connection is a kind of a good mm-hmm. platform for this thing. But it was started where the content was originally, you know, created by a website. And it still exists for both web and mobile today. So the type of notes that were created to get started were initially all authored on the web. And then when we launched the iPhone app first, that allowed you to both use it and author it on a mobile device. So they had some effort to try and ship a version for iOS, and they weren't really pleased with the results. And then I joined, and I think we released it, and I think everybody was pleased with the results. It was heavily featured by Apple, which was nice.
Okay.
So that was helping getting it started, and multiple versions were made, and it still exists today, and it's work I'm really very proud of.
The way you describe it, it sounds like it initially would have been one of those apps built for mobile first.
Yes.
Is there any reason that the web approach was taken initially?
And, well, that yeah. So I mean, it's precisely.
Do you think if they started today, they'd be doing the same thing, or they'd be going mobile first these days?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that you have to get started with something, right? So it was designed with mobile in mind, but you know, to get a mobile app that really works well takes a fair amount of time and iteration. And,
yes,
and
absolutely.
You have to go through a lot of failures. And but in this particular case, since it's you know, nobody's going to pull out their phone in a physical place and say, okay, what's there, unless there's something there. It's like there's something, you know, you can describe as the empty restaurant phenomenon. If you walk by a restaurant and nobody's there, it could have the best menu, the best ingredients, the best, you know, chef and staff, but you don't see anybody there, you think it couldn't be any good. So, you know, the reason why it was developed.
You know, I always wondered about that. You walk past a restaurant, but if you walk around outside around 9 o'clock, mm-hmm. people are there. So at some point it was empty, but right. for some reason some of them fill up, and right. some of them don't.
It's and it's funny because in certain locations there can be like a stink that's on a restaurant. It's actually a real phenomenon that they consider a jinx or whatnot. But then. The right formula comes along. I mean, that's actually the case around the corner for me in the Mission. There was this restaurant that was a bar, and then was a bar and grill, and then it was a kind of a fancy restaurant. They all failed. But more recently, it's a restaurant that's absolutely taken off. It got an enormous James Beard Award, and now you can't get a table for love or money. It's the same physical location, but the right formula
Amazing.
Was found. And in fact, that's very apropos for the world of startups and products in general. You can try things, and you can even have the same idea that gets, you know, attempted multiple times. Sometimes you have to wait for the right confluence of events for it to be successful. But, you know, just to finish up with the thing about Findery is that you had to have starting points of content. And so while the software was being iterated, the mobile software, the web version was relatively speaking pretty easy to ship. And there it's a lot more forgiving. You know, you have a keyboard, you have ability to copy and paste very, very easily from let's say other websites. If you wanted to copy a link that refers to something, you know, to give some context, whether it's say a Wikipedia article or whatever, right? So you can get started with it. And there already was a community of active users of Flickr, for example, who then came on to Findery just because they like the community aspects of Flickr. So many of the early power users of Findery had been and perhaps still are power users even of Flickr. So that explains why it was done, you know, web before for mobile. But ultimately, you know, mobile became the highest volume traffic for it.
When you started, how many people worked there, and how many people were still working there by the time that you moved on?
It was you know, pretty much all the time I was there, it was a bloated organization with 12 people.
Wow, that's huge.
and so yeah, but yeah, it is huge. And that was one of the most lovely aspects of it. You know, the everything about it in many ways was kind of contrarian. For one thing, you know, female founder and a gender balanced team. That's I think already a great starting point. The office was actually in a residential loft in a neighborhood called Hayes Valley, which is very hip now. It had been kind of a bad neighborhood, I guess, you know, up until 10, 15 years ago, actually as a neighborhood that has a kind of interesting history in that it was a lot of it was in the shadow mm-hmm. of a freeway. And there was an earthquake in San Francisco in 1989, and it caused the destruction of these elevated freeways that went all the way along the waterfront and went through the city. And where it went through the city, there were just places, you know, where people would shoot up drugs, and there was kind of a, it was, you know, they have this phenomenon in American cities of the the bad side of the railroad tracks. You know, that's the bad side of town, or you think about places like the South Bronx in our imagination and movies and whatnot. You saw, you know, just utter destruction where a freeway would go up and it would divide cities and cast shadows and create kind of bad things. Well, after the earthquake, eventually, you know, all these elevated freeways, for the most part, were torn down in San Francisco, and a bunch of neighborhoods were reborn. So the Embarcadero in you know, along the waterfront and Hayes Valley. So, you know, there was a fortuitous opportunity to get an office space which was very, very comfortable and felt like home, because it literally was a home, as versus, you know, a cubicle farm, which would be the more typical thing. And, you know, in fact, there was a pretty lengthy profile of Findry, the company, and Katharina Fake, the founder, and about the unusual office that we lived in, which is kind of decorated with odds and ends of a lifetime of travel and lots of books. And we had a nice kitchen and plants and comfortable, you know, places to sit and spend time with each other. And, you know, Why would you talk about this on a startup show? But I think it's absolutely key and important that if you, any venture you're doing, no matter what it is, the product or service you're trying to create, ultimately they are created by human beings, and the more comfortable, you know, human beings can be, the better. And I think a lot of some of my fondest memories of launching products and working on teams and building teams is just the fun aspects of, you know, if you're going to spend time with people, making sure that you have interesting people to spend time with and having interesting conversations outside of the particular thing that you're working on, just makes the, you know, what makes human beings happier tends to translate into more humane Indeed. And better products.
You mentioned building teams. If we can stay on that a bit. So obviously, mm-hmm. That part of the world is a very energetic and vibrant place, and I'm going to make the assumption that it comes with a very specific set of challenges when it comes to hiring people and building a team. So, and when we met up last time in the real world, you kind of touched up on that, but I think it's a great opportunity for you to mention on the podcast, because I thought it was a lot of interesting, fascinating stuff that we could learn from.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a funny thing. So, you know, Silicon Valley, everybody's, you know, thinks that's the place to go. And a lot has changed in the last 3 years, and I will give great credit to the folks at Amsterdam and the folks basically who have been building startup scenes all over the world. And I think that now there's beginning to be a realization that you don't only have to do it in Silicon Valley. I mean, there's, you know, it is the center of the universe in many aspects, that the largest companies are here, the biggest amounts of venture capital are spent here, you know, in Silicon Valley. And as a result, it creates, you know, a very difficult economic set of prospects, because it's an extremely expensive place to live. So salaries kind of necessarily have to be high already. And because there's lots of competition chasing a relatively, you know, smaller number of people that can actually be there, it means that finding people is very difficult. I mean, even related to Findry, it was, you know, you can have top flight founders, you know, plenty of cash in the bank from the venture round that you raised, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can find the right people. And so that can be really tricky. And I kind of try to flip things around a little bit and wave the flag for these kind of lesser known environments, including Athens. You know, nobody would have thought, why on earth are you going to Athens, and what could there possibly be there? But there are some super smart people here. There are super smart people all over the world. I mean, to have this idea that
all over the place, yes,
right. Absolutely. To have this idea thinking that only smart people, you know, exist in America is really dumb. And in fact, you know, the fact that there are lots of smart people in America, a lot of it has to do with immigration. I don't want to kind of go off on that topic, but I think that you know, now is a great opportunity that if you work in other areas of the world to be able to proudly stand up and say, yeah, we can do great work here. You know, I listened to an episode where you were talking to the guy who made Horizon. Fantastic piece of software engineering, fantastic piece of marketing. I looked at the video that he made. I thought it was great. So, you know, I think it makes me very happy to know that these places exist, and that, you know, people stand up, and it presents great opportunities that, you know, if you are creating a company and you're looking to take your, you know, relatively limited amounts of capital, you know, not everybody has a startup budget like Uber or other kind of hyper-funded companies have. So, you know, if you are able to raise a very small seed round and or even a small Series A where you're talking about, you know, a few million dollars, you might should consider, you know, finding development teams and distributing them and finding people in places that are less, you know, insanely expensive to live and places where people would be thrilled to be able to do work and stay, you know, with their family and where they want to be rather than having to pick up and move to London or pick up and move to San Francisco, take advantage of you know, the talent that's available in other parts of the world and make your money go further. Mm. And create up and the last thing to say is, like, if you're building a product for the world, it should be made by and from people around the world and not just people who kind of only think to try to address, you know, the market that exists in places like San Francisco.
Makes sense. I read somewhere a while back that from an employer point of view, the best employees don't live within a 20-mile or kilometer radius from your offices. And from the employee standpoint, the best employers aren't 20 miles or kilometers from your home. So it makes perfect sense what you're saying. And we're definitely seeing that a lot, international or location or remote recruitment. Mm-hmm. Cool. Anything else you'd like to talk about for Findery, or maybe we can move on to your more current role?
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, I think just the last thing to say is that it is a product and a project that for me was just very, very satisfying to work on. I still love using it. I'm super proud of it. I think one thing to say about it is, like, did it set the world on fire? No. In a way, I feel like, you know, we created the New Yorker magazine for the internet. It's kind of a clean, well-lighted place for people who enjoy art and culture and music and all those different, you know, things that make life happy and worth living. But, you know, it's a very different thing trying to compete against, you know, in the end, there is Facebook, and then there's kind of, you know, WhatsApp and Instagram and you know, three or four other networks that kind of, depending on whether you are over 30 or under 30, that take care of all your social media needs, and anything outside of those are almost, you know, kind of destined to be confined as niche, and niche can be fine, you know, it's always kind of, you know, it's always an interesting challenge to start off and thinking, I'm going to become the next huge thing of that. And, you know, it's possible. People have done it, but it's much less likely that it will, just because, you know, competition is fierce.
You mentioned that you were featured at some point on the App Store.
Mm-hmm.
Did that help in your engagement?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Any tips for to achieving the holy grail of being featured?
Well, you know, I think step zero is to have a good product, and I am not being facetious about it. I mean, you know, Apple, as you can imagine, you know, prides itself on the quality of their product and their services. And so if they're going to feature a third party piece of software and associate the Apple brand, the Apple kind of imprimatur on it, the product or service better be awesome. And so if you're not awesome, don't go there yet. But it takes time to develop relationships with you know, evangelists at Apple. So, I mean, you know, the best thing you can do is to, you know, in some ways it's probably a little bit easier now because Apple used to be very California-centric. And, you know, WWDC, you know, if you came to California and you could have the chance to meet there, that may be your first opportunity and only opportunity during the year. But I think, you know, some number of years ago, they started having events, you know, in other parts of the world. Part of it was just, I guess, a practical thing, because at a developer conference like WWDC, you have the chance, 5,000 lucky people get to be there once a year. And that's not enough for Apple, you know, to be able to find interesting new third-party apps, or for those third-party, you know, developers to find Apple. And so they started doing, you know, tours, right? So when they would roll out, you know, new technology, you know, they would start to have tours and tech demo days. And I think that if one comes near you, take the time to go out there and just remember that you're basically, you're forming a relationship with a person. You know, it takes time and it takes persistence, but if you are a nice person and you're respectful and kind and courteous, it goes a long way. So kind of remember what your grandparents taught you about being a good human being, apply those lessons and start to form relationships with people at Apple. And stay in contact and keep them up to date with what you're working on. So, you know, it may take 6 months, it may take a year, it may take 2 years for you to really refine your app, your product, your service, whatever. But don't wait until it's done to start getting in contact, but get in contact and say, hey, I'm working on this and we think it's great and I love to give you a demo and keep up with it. You know, from Apple's point of view, I think they're very happy when people reach out to them as well, especially if they're kind and courteous and they're working on something great.
And thanks for the pro tip. So currently you're working with a well-known company called Netflix.
Yeah, I joined a tiny company called Netflix. I think some people have heard of it.
I'd like to ask you a couple of things, a bit on the technical side since we're talking. And then, I've listened to your own podcast, and maybe you can let our listeners know a bit about it later. So I was fascinated by the localization stuff you were talking about. So Netflix is localized in all of the languages, pretty much.
We haven't covered every single language, but many of them, and we're still adding additional ones. Okay. So, Netflix.
I want to just ask you, how many people on the iOS app team?
It depends on.
I'm sorry, just to interrupt that. I'm sure localization isn't the most exciting topic in the world right now. So how many people in the iOS team? Maybe that'll be of more interest to people.
It depends on how you define it. I mean, the main people who work on the user interface of the app. They're 12 people, a 12 person team. And that's including designers software engineers and people who are dedicated to QA. You know, there's a whole series of design resources who cover different platforms, and there's also a separate team that work on some other aspects of it. And then there's platform teams that work on code that gets shared, for instance, between the Apple TV application and the iOS thing. So if you were to ask the total number of people who are touching it, I honestly don't even know the number. But the direct people that are working on the app itself is a relatively small team.
Okay. What language is it written in primarily?
Objective-C. That's an Objective-C app. And
I just want to say here that you probably get that asked a lot, and a lot of people working on smaller apps or new apps got into Swift relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. But I just want to say that the more you go out there and talk to people, Objective-C is still very strong, and a lot of the libraries that you work with and depend on are written in Objective-C. I simply asked about out of curiosity. Are you looking at it at all? Is it something that you guys could be interested in? I know that a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's the case that there's many things to recommend Swift. It's a great language. I think there's also, people who have written Swift applications since day one and then had to rewrite them. As the APIs changed and then kind of are looking for the signal moment when you have binary interoperability and compatibility. I think when that happens, that will change things a lot. But I think the other thing too is that there's a difference between writing a brand new application from scratch where you have no dependencies beyond on the CocoaTouch and related frameworks. If you're shipping a product like of a scale of Netflix or Facebook or whatever, particularly as concerns Netflix, you know, streaming video and having to do digital rights management, you know, a lot of that is, it's complicated stuff, and it's been solved and doesn't need to be solved multiple times. So we're not going to, you know, do a complete rewrite of top to bottom all in Swift of things relating to, you know, DRM, for example. It's just, it's not going to happen. And so, and some of the code is C++, and interfacing Objective-C and C++, you can mix and match. There is such a thing as an Objective C++ file, a .mm file. Objective C++. And so doing that with Swift ends up, you know, it's technically possible, but then you end up writing an Objective-C wrapper around that, and so it's just much less fun, and and you're not getting any benefit from it. So I mean, I think that you know, when it's all said and done, you know, what makes, I think the thing that makes developing software for Apple platforms, in my mind, is the quality of the frameworks, right? It's not necessarily the language. I mean, you know, you can argue, and I buy it, because I've been doing this since the days of NextStep and WebObjects, so I am an old timer on this. There's certain things about Objective-C and the super dynamism of it, which allowed these beautifully designed frameworks to come to exist, and I think we'll see that in Swift over time as well. But it takes time. And I would say that, you know, when you start seeing frameworks that are written entirely in Swift, that will change a lot. But right now,
I wholeheartedly agree. With these mobile platforms, it's all about the learning curve is the SDKs, the frameworks, right. The language can be described. I mean, I'm sure you can become an expert within a Swift playground doing computer science stuff within a couple of days. But I think the nuance comes in knowing the actual SDK and the components and UI kit and core animation, what have you.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I had the opportunity to work on a video app a while back. And so you probably have a lot of expert video people working at Netflix. Where do they come from? Because my experience was that it's more like a black art of programming and codings and frames and it's great.
Yeah, well, video.
Where are these people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Video covers so many things. Well, I mean, and again, you kind of have to see, well, you know, what exactly do you mean by that? I mean, like then the whole video encoding side, I think, you know, Netflix has innovated like crazy in that
area. It has, absolutely.
Just because they've had to, right? So when, and so just, you know, and continues to do so. You know, one thing is new compression techniques, and there are articles, so I'm not, you know, revealing anything that's not already publicly known. But you know, there are different techniques for encoding.
The question actually behind this is more like for somebody interested in getting to an area like a niche area with a startup is, how would you go about to find people with a super focused skill set like that?
Well, I mean, it's like, how do you find people in anything? I guess, you know, attending meetups, you know, going to conferences like NS Conference, you know, long live NS Conference. I wish it still existed, but there are other ones that are similar to it, you know. So I think, you know, these non-Apple conferences are great places to go and find people. And podcasts are good. You know, oftentimes people who have expertise tend to have podcasts or they blog, or, you know, so I think it's not rocket science to get in touch to find out who has expertise in those things. That's in some ways the easy part. The harder part is vying for their attention in whatever way, you know, whether you are trying to get answers to a question that's been stumping you, or you're looking to hire somebody on a contract basis or to have an employee. But I think the techniques are kind of similar to finding any expert. There's it's, you just have to look, but you know, you have to look, and you might get names from the web, but in the end there's no substitute for you know, physical contact.
Absolutely.
You know, to meet somebody face to face to establish that type of relationship.
I assume millions of people on a daily basis use application. I work on a smaller app currently, What happens with an app like do you get a sense of scale within the app? Does that become apparent? For example,
yes, it does. I mean, and kind of one of the reasons why I was very happy to join Netflix is, one is like I really love the team I work with. They're just smart and humble and just fun to work with, and we do work that we're all proud of. In my career, I had started out doing enterprise software. So I'd written pieces of software where, you know, it was licensed for $1 million, you know, at a time and with professional services and support and so on and so forth, but used by, you know, dozens of people at a company. So I wrote software being used by places like Sony Pictures or Martha Stewart or, you know, companies like that produced valuable media. But it's still kind of big ticket software, small user base. Findery and you know, my own product Memory Miner before that, or, you know, used by the tens of thousands of people. So to join a product that you know, to join a team where you ship it and millions of people are using it right away, it was great. It was it's something that kind of I could tick that box in my life and say I've done it from, you know. Software that costs, you know, the software is free, you pay for the service, but, you know, to be used by millions. So I've kind of covered it from both ends. Part of what it, you get a sense of it right away is that you have to be very careful, because if you make a mistake, it echoes right away. And that can be embarrassing. So you do have to be careful. And you also have to realize that there is a pretty long tail. You know, when you are writing a software and you have relatively small numbers of users, or you're writing any software that, you know, if you build a Mac app or you be an iOS app that you charge for that does a very specific thing, in a way you can kind of choose your own customers very carefully, and you might be able to say, I can get away with only supporting iOS 9 and above, or I only support, you know, certain models of devices. It's a little bit trickier to do that when you are you know, continuing a product for a service that's been around for a long time. So, you know, an example is, you know, we still support older devices with original 30-pin connectors, right? And there was a whole set of accessories that were supported with that. And there were people who kind of, you know, go to an exercise club and plop their old device into something and watch a video on a screen in front of them. That thing exists. So, yeah. So
it's amazing. I'm trying to think which was the most recent 30-pin device.
I don't even know. I'm going to guess it would be an iPhone 4S or something. I should know this, but I don't. Thankfully, I have people.
All right, so we're talking.
I can ask. Yeah, it's
5 years ago. Okay.
Something like that. Yeah, there's you know, some of the last bit of hardware still able to run iOS 8 and above, and even iOS 9 and above. So you have to kind of make sure that those things work and you can test with them, because.
Okay, so at the moment you've drawn the line at iOS 8.
We have now actually done it with iOS 9. With the release that we put out there a couple weeks ago. Now And so, basically, that's a nice thing you can do, is because we haven't left people behind completely. The old app works just fine. You know, if there were absolutely critical death bugs, you know, I'm sure we would fix it. But I think that we tend to QA our product pretty well.
No, I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
It works flawlessly. I've never actually had a bad experience with it, to be honest.
That's lovely to hear. At some point, you know, in a way, Apple makes that job possible for us, because at some point they stop supporting certain versions. And, you know, as concerns iOS 9, there comes along when there are technologies you'd really love to use, and you say, gosh, I'd really, you know, like to be able to do this, right? And one thing is Stacks, for example. Stacks, you know, solve a problem for grouping objects together in a view hierarchy, where you're containing objects, but you don't really need to have all the heaviness of a view, right? So you can make subviews as many as you want, but then you have all the other things that come along with a view for hit detection and detecting, you know, the gestures and so on and so forth, where you're just using the containment capacity of a view and not the input capacity. So Stacks is nice that it kind of allows you to do the collection, you know, containment stuff.
Yeah, and they're iOS 9 minimum, so
yep, right. So
I suppose you have no issues at the moment with that.
Right, so yeah. And then, you know, you have other technologies and then other types of things. You know, you bring up video, you know, Apple, you know, when you publish an API, you kind of have to maintain it, and you have to, that's one reason why people tend to be very, very careful about what they make public, right? And so people can tell that there's private API used by Apple applications themselves, and you know, there's ways of finding that out, and then you can say, gosh, I wish that was public, and then you kind of think to yourself, why doesn't Apple make all that public? And then you realize that once something is made public, you have to support it until the end of time, and so you be very careful about making that choice
all the way. Yeah.
And so you know, an API is one thing, but then implementations of that API can change from one operating system version to the next, and you can see subtle problems or subtle things that just are different between, you know, even point versions of API, of operating systems, and bugs that, you know, mm-hmm. Apple's not immune to having bugs. We have bugs. Every software does have bugs. So that can be a little bit tricky, and sometimes you just have to work around those things. So in an ideal world, you can kind of, you know, choose to be on relatively speaking the bleeding edge. I think the more practical thing to do is to support kind of at least one major version back, and it's a lot easier to do that now when you can see definitively what the pickup of iOS is, you know, from the point that they made over the air updates and made the updates based on deltas. It's practically speaking a lot easier to just allow auto updating to work its magic, and people tend to be, you know, on the latest version. It's a lot easier on iOS in that regard than Android, for example.
Absolutely. Anything else you'd like to talk about?
You know, you'd ask about localization. There's yes. Something else. And accessibility. You know, those are things that I work on a fair amount. Accessibility, I will wave the flag for that.
Me too. Do you mind if I just tell my own accessibility story?
Yeah.
Because I really love saying this. So I was working on a ride sharing app a few years ago that had full accessibility, still has. And as a matter of fact, the number one rider for that app was a lady with her vision wasn't 100%, so she depended on that. And that was back in the day before it was 24 hours in your life, or even less than that. So we made a terrible mistake, and the map at the front row center screen of the app wasn't accessible as a previous version with a mistake we made, and she couldn't use it. And we brought her in and gave her a build direct from our MacBooks so she can continue using it. So I realized then that a lot of people depend on this. And I mean, iOS as a platform, that's tremendous stuff for people that require accessibility. And that's what has a special place in my heart. And I go out of my way to support it where I can in apps that I work on.
That's lovely, and it's there's just no reason not to do it. I mean, as I think Apple even themselves have said, you could not care at all about accessibility. You could say, I could not care less if a blind person can use my app or not. But then you might say, but I love testing my app, and I love building automation tests. And so you could just take advantage of accessibility just by doing that. And in fact, you know, that's, you know, there's a colleague of mine that also really cares about accessibility, and he comes from the QA side. So what he found is that in order to make automation possible, you have to have accessibility labels, which identify the objects in your viewer hierarchy. Accessibility identifiers. And then he says, well, it's hardly any additional effort just to add a little accessibility label here to make things clear. And then, you know, when I joined, I also kind of do really care about it, and I got to enjoy, you know, just the finesse of it. And I think one of the proudest moments is when we shipped this new version that I worked on, and I guess it was last spring, I want to say February, I think, when we shipped it. There's an accessibility website called Apple Viz, and they said, "Wow, you know, this is like they were floored. They were like so happy that so much effort had been put into making the app accessible." And my colleague and I kind of joined in the conversation, say, "Hey, you know, we're so happy. Thank you so much for the kind words. By all means, please let us know what's wrong, how we can make it better." And we have, and we've continued to improve it. I think to talk about kind of the intersection of accessibility and localization, I think that we've kind of scratched our heads a little bit about is that Netflix basically takes its localization cues from the members' preferred languages. So you can go on the Netflix website and say, you know, I speak Italian, but you may have a shared device where the device language is set to English. And so you can launch Netflix, and then Netflix will say, you know, we're going to present ourselves in Italian. Or you could do it in Arabic to use an even more complicated case.
I see what you're saying. I think that's an established best practice for now, using the device.
Well, if you possibly can, it's great. But practically speaking, you know, there are arguments to both. Kind of where we net out on it is that we have to kind of trust our users, and Netflix does exist on multiple devices, multiple platforms, and so we follow the user. And you can switch accounts, you can switch profiles, and each profile can have its own language settings. So just because the iPhone is itself working in English doesn't mean that you shouldn't be able to, in an ideal world, be able to use the Netflix app and service in Arabic. And largely that's possible. It's full of challenges, but there are certain things that we can't possibly fix. And one of such things is accessibility, because the accessibility trait of an object, let's say, might be a button. So the voiceover, if you slide your finger across it, it will identify it as a button, and it will speak the word button in whatever the device locale is set. But then the accessibility label that says what will happen if you tap on the button will be in your app. So it can sound funny. And my poor colleagues, when I'm testing it and I don't have, I forget to have headphones on, they'll like hear button, and then something in Arabic. And I can't speak Arabic. I don't even want to pretend, but it sounds comical. So that's fun. But, you know, these things happen.
Cool. Anything else for our listeners before we start winding down tonight's episode?
Nothing. I guess for the listeners, one is hello, listeners. Second thing I think always focus on the humane aspects of software development. I wave this flag a lot. You know, I didn't study computer science in college. I studied international relations and music, and I discovered that I could learn, and if I was humble and asked a lot of questions and had a lot of patience, you know, could turn into, I think, you know, a good software engineer with time and effort. But what I think that what inspires me is even what you were saying. It's like when you care about quality and you care about user experience and care about the fact that software is used by human beings, could be your mom, could be your friend, could be your family, you know, care about those things. And I think that it will help. And care about the people that you work with, and take time to, you know, enjoy the ride. You know, one of the things that happens with startups is you never have enough money, usually, and so, you know, you may be at the point where you, as a founder, in order to make payroll, didn't take salary, you know, this week or this month, and you may not have spare money to go out to eat all the time. So what about having a potluck lunch? You know, take some time, take an hour out of the day, let people bring in some piece of, you know, some food, enjoy the conviviality of your fellow teammates. It will make life happier, and it will ultimately make your product better, because good products come from good human beings who
Excellent.
Are happy.
Beautiful. Where can we find you? Anything you'd like to mention about stuff you're working on or you participate in?
Yeah.
Feel free to tell us.
Well, so, you know, Sure. So, I mean, you can find the product that I work on at Netflix. Findery is available and still in great use. And if you want to say mean things to me or nice things to me on Twitter, I'm Djembe. That's Djembe, like the West African drum.
Great. Thanks for being with us tonight. You can email us your questions at hello@listenshiprepeat.com. You can subscribe on iTunes by searching for Listen Ship Repeat. You can review us on iTunes if you enjoy our show. It energizes us, keeps us coming back for more. And you can also send us a question by calling us on 866-370-5050 from anywhere. Thank you so much, John Fox, for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, listeners. We'll talk soon. Good night.